This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell. Brahma's also in the studio, keeping up the positive vibes. But before we go any further, huge thanks to Jeff? Get his name right, for another excellent edition of On The Record. Always a pleasure for you on Monday morning. Of course, you can catch On The Record, though, here on RTR every weekday morning from 9 a.m. Also, big thanks to Brianna for the RTRFM news. She'll be back at 12 o'clock. But as I said, and as perhaps you know, this is the Indie Media Show. All the news, views, and interviews from the online interwebs. And on today's show, we're going to be talking a bit about the ongoing demonstrations in Colombia. The street protests in Colombia began some 2 months ago on the basis of a widespread opposition to regressive tax changes proposed by the government of Iván Duque. Duque was forced to withdraw those proposals, but within a matter of days. However, the protests continued. To discuss exactly what's going on in Colombia, a little later in the show, we're going to be speaking to a Colombian political activist, Christian, for obvious reasons. We won't give you his full name. Also on the show today, we're going to be talking about the history of environmental blockades, both here in Australia and also elsewhere in the United States and Canada. Ian McIntyre has just authored a new book, Environmental Blockades, Obstructive Direct Action and the History of the Environmental Movement. Now, while there is obviously a wealth of research into protest movements, particularly here in Australia, often there's been a lack of discussion on the role of direct action and blockading in these movements and to save our precious environment and natural areas. So we'll be hearing from Dr. McIntyre a little later in the show to find out about the new book. As I said at the top of the show, street protests in Colombia began some 2 months ago on the basis of a widespread opposition to regressive tax changes proposed by the government of Iván Duque. Duque was forced to withdraw those proposals within a matter of days, but the protests continued. To discuss the question of why those protests morphed into a more generalised anti-government movement, Indie Media's Alex Wisson spoke to Colombian political activist Christian.
I think the reason is it's an accumulation of different situations that have been affecting a lot of the people during the last year and 2 years. So there are a lot of problems and with the COVID. For example, it was a big thing that influenced a lot in make people feel desperate about the what is happening. But also it's like a long history of corruption. It's a long history of inequality. It's a long history of poverty and misery. So the last few years since this president is in the power, it's been intensified, the killing against social and political activists, and the after the agreements of with FARC, it's been a very big mess in Colombia in terms of safety and all the different groups that has been coming out of this agreement, and it's been they continue in confronting the state through the use of weapons and arms, it's been intensifying the social crisis. So it's a lot of violence, and there is a different violence that is happening in Colombia against the people that are like violence. Yeah, poverty is a type of violence. The violence itself, like the killings, is a thing that is very worrying. Like it's something that people really, really is stressed about. And yeah, it's like a long history of crisis.
So very much it's reached boiling point and it's spilled over with these mass protests. Tell us about the composition of the protests themselves, Christian, and their political direction. It's often very hard to get a real flavour or feel for what is happening, you know, with protests happening. It's so far away. So are they largely student and youth-led protests, for instance, and what's the working class involvement, and also what's the involvement of trade unions?
Yeah, so in this case, exactly what I was saying, like people is tired. So there are different groups of people pulling or trying to catch the attention of people to protest against and try to find a solution and a change in the way how the government is dealing with the whole situation, the economic situation. So it's basically students. I think a big part of the protesters are students. And the student movement is very, very important in the history of Colombia. And the second one, like the unions were involved until some point, but what is happening here is also like is joining people that I wasn't involved before with groups or activism. So it's people that has been put against the wall, and they just protesting because it's actually it's easier to protest and go and get food in the protest, you know, than, for example, find your own food every day, you know, because there is no jobs, there is no work, there is nothing. So in some way, I think the composition of the protest is like is very diverse, but also the people is very politicized. So it's also not about like a politician or this party or no, it's also like people that is looking for a change. And Colombia is not like a poor country. It's a very rich country. But the problem is like the misery is because there is a big gap between the rich and the poor. And everything goes in the way that the rich are more rich and the poor are more poor. So that's a reality in Colombia. And yeah, there are people that are pushed to do things like, for example, get involved in crime and stuff for this situation. So the composition now, and this is something that has been happening, the original organizations that are, like, they call for the protests, they were unions, students, and some political, like, parties and stuff like that, and the society in general, like, organizations like neighbor organizations, like grassroots organizations, they all came to the rallies and the strike. But the continuum at the moment is like there are people that are, especially the young people, is they don't feel represented for these organizations anymore, and they really want to achieve a change, I think, through like, yeah, the resistance and different demonstrations of resistance, you know? So I think that's what is happening at the moment. As I say, it's a social bomb for like the last 60 years. So finally, it explodes in the face of everyone, you know? That's what is happening.
It's a good way of describing it. You mentioned the violence of the state of the Duque government before, Christian, and the question of police brutality, police terrorism really has been central to the protests. A lot of people killed, a lot of people disappeared as well. Explain to our listeners a little bit the role of the police historically in Colombia, that, you know, the nature of the crimes they've committed against protesters and their supporters in recent weeks.
Well, the police in Colombia is, I think, is one of the institutions that are more corrupted than anyone in Colombia. I think also like the police and the army is an institution that works and it has too much power, too much. I will say it works like a mafia. because the families of people that are generals, like captains, like everything, this high range military, are families that have been in the army for many, many, many generations. And these people obviously are part of the richest in Colombia. So the police work in two ways. Like, if you touch one of them, it's like you touch all them. And they just, their behavior is like a gang more than a police officer. You know, like there is no training in human rights. Like, the police in Colombia is training for a war, because we've been in a civil war for 50 years. So obviously the way how they deal with the situations are in this more brutal and violent way they can, because they're not looking for negotiate. They're looking to repress and exterminate the protest through the use of violence. And the thing is, like, this is not new, but the police in Colombia has been like, well, it's never been on the side of the people. It's more on the side of the people that own things. And they protect more property over people, you know, over lives. So it's very well known, like, the budget for police and army in Colombia, it is pretty much the 50 or 60% of the PIB or PDA of the country. It goes for security and weapons and training and all these things.
So there is a formidable security state, military state that the protesters are up against, and recently the president has deployed the military, for instance, to suppress protests in the city of Cali, where there's been a lot of street conflicts, and the government does seem determined to continue, as you say, to really crush the protests by force, which leaves the question of where you see things going from here. Christian, will these protests continue to grow? Will they continue to politically develop? Will they potentially be able to, you know, to overthrow the government even?
Yeah, well, the deploy of the military is also, I think it's, instead of negotiate, it's like the way of like a fascist government acts, is like, is the use of force for any other means possible. And I think what is going to happen is, or what is happening is already, is like the government is trying to push laws that are totally anti-constitutional to repress more and have more power and give more power to the army. So we actually talking about like erasing rights, for example, to protest, you know? And I think that's creating more conflict, because people is tired. And Colombia also have a long history of people struggling, you know? And people know how to do it. And what is happening now is like people is organizing in the small groups and in their own neighborhoods, in their own communities, and trying to supply what the government is not supplying. Yeah? And this is a long history in Colombia of people doing this. Like, this is a long, long history. Like, the presence of the state is not really visible. It's like, it's very poor, the whole country. But the only presence you can see that is strong and is stable is the army presence from the state. That is a police state, it's an army state. There is no explanation of why Colombia has a million of people, like million of reservists and military forces in the region. Why? Well, but there is a reason, and it's because there is a war, a civil war that I haven't been recognized as a civil war. But the other reason is because Colombia is the best ally of United States, and the Plan Colombia and a lot of different eyes that the United States gives to Colombia is exactly to create control over that. Also, with the excuse of the war against drugs, but it's also to create a control and a base of to control South America in different ways. And yeah, Colombia has 11 bases of United States in Colombia, you know? So it's very clear that it's a police state and it's an army state. And the police have a lot of power, too much power. Yeah. So
murder, like people getting disappeared, it's a long practices in Colombia that is being implemented by the police and the state, you know, to create terror in the people and suppress any kind of uprising or whatever you want to call, like, rebellion or awakeness, or I don't know. But it's that's the politic of the state. And, well, it's a fascist politic, obviously.
That was Colombian political activist Christian speaking to Indie Media's Alex Wisson about the ongoing anti-government protests in Colombia.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
Now, the history of environmentalism and social movements and protest here in Australia and elsewhere around the world, unfortunately, it's not something that's often covered, at least from a historical perspective. But a new book, Environmental Blockades, Obstructive Direct Action and the History of the Environmental Movement, by Ian McIntyre, seeks to just address that, at least in the context of looking at forest blockades here in Australia and also in the USA and Canada. I had the opportunity to speak to Dr. McIntyre a little earlier this morning, and I began by just asking Dr. McIntyre exactly what his initial, I guess, motivation for writing this book was.
Yeah, so I've been, not so much in recent years, but in the late 80s and through the 90s and 2000s, I was involved with sort of various blockades and environmental groups. I was involved with Campaign to Save Native Forests in Western Australia in the late 80s, early 90s, and Rainforest Action Group and various other things. So I had been involved with various blockades and done research about, I guess, history of various Australian radical and social change movements in general. So I became interested in, I guess, how blockades became a kind of a strategy and I suppose a form of tactics that activists could turn to. Because obviously these, you know, things don't come out of nowhere. And so I was interested in what were the roots of blockading, and I guess also I was interested in where tactics came from. So things like you know, tree sitting and lock-ons and stuff. I'd heard various stories from people, but so that was sort of the genesis for it, was trying to find out, how this kind of became a thing, you know, that you know, when faced with environmental destruction, people could turn to, and how the body of tactics around it, and I guess approaches to how to do it, what was the best way to do it, what was the ethical way to do it, and that kind of thing came about. So I carried out the research as part of a PhD thesis, I was lucky and blessed or what have you to have a whole lot of people who were open to being interviewed about it, and there was some collections I was able to come across. There's a collection in the State Library of New South Wales called the Rainbow Collection, which always makes me think of the Rainbow Connection, but there's about 40 or 50 boxes there of all sorts of different stuff from northern New South Wales, kind of alternative rainbow region, and there was a whole load of campaigns materials that I discovered in there, and some campaigns that I wasn't so much aware of, and you know, kind of hopefully have brought to life the sort of their importance. And I guess the other part of it was trying to explore what are the continuities and what were the sort of lessons and things that we could be carried forward from earlier periods.
Now, on that, I guess one thing that unfortunately I at least have witnessed over my last couple of decades of involvement with activism is that perhaps activists aren't so great at sharing intergenerational knowledge, and maybe that is changing now. But was that also, I guess, a motivating factor for you, is that unfortunately, what tends to happen in these kind of communities is that people come in and they typically sort of, you know, maybe spend a decade or two involved in social movements, but inevitably they either burn out or they move on with their lives. And then a new generation of activists come along. And often it seems as though people are having to reinvent the wheel to some extent. Do you hope that the book serves, some purpose in terms of addressing that and at least passing on some of the lessons learned by the blockades from the 80s onwards?
Yeah, well, definitely. You've encapsulated it very well. I mean, I've always been a bit of a history buff, but I got into writing about radical history and particularly Australian history precisely to try and help overcome that. Not just, I guess, to, even though, you know, it's very important itself, to sort of show people, you know, this is what other people have been through and maybe, you know, you need to consider these things. But also to give, I guess, people a sense that they're part of a tradition, you know, and that often, you know, activism can, depending on the issue you're working on or whatever, can feel quite lonely and quite isolated and, you know, why is it all worth it or whatever. And so I guess looking at the reasons that other people have had in the past can sort of help inspire people, but also to show that you can have, you know, issues that are very unpopular at one point, but it sort of takes somebody to get the ball rolling. And, you know, depending on sort of mixture of strategy and intuition and the right conditions or whatever, you know, you can go from being very isolated to really making change. So I wanted to get that across. And, yeah, just to give, you know, and I suppose there's also, whilst on the one hand you often do have people reinventing the wheel or, you know, having to come up with things from scratch, on the other hand you often have, you may have certain organisations or activists or whatever who are really prescriptive and will say, you know, this is how we did it in this case and therefore that's going to hold true forever. So we must always apply these tactics and we must always apply these approaches to you know, what's kind of behaviours acceptable or what kind of tactics are acceptable. And so it's been important to me to kind of show that, yeah, there's a whole range of things can work in different contexts. And that, generally I think being very prescriptive is not the way to go.
And on that, Ian, I guess, you know, one of the problems I think that many sort of protest movements, social movements face is very much that they tend to fall into patterns of repetition in terms of, you know, I guess many of our listeners and yourself would be aware that, you know, a protest march now has almost been reduced almost to some kind of spectacle in the sense that people tend to repeat the same formula again and again. Looking at this research, I mean, you started with some of the campaigns here in Australia, I believe one of the campaigns, the Tirania Creek campaign, and then moved Tirania Creek, and then moved through Australia, and then eventually into the United States and Canada. I guess was one of the things you were looking at a sort of critical reflection on what worked and what was effective. And can you talk to that in terms of, you know, this question of not repeating the same mistakes or just repeating the same actions for the sake of them? Was that part of the book? And, you know, actually analysing what worked, what didn't work, what was effective, and, you know, and what that might demonstrate to today's environmentalists and activists.
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely analysis in there of, I suppose, outcomes. Part of those outcomes are what the different campaigns set out to achieve at the beginning, but I also kind of explore, I guess, other outcomes in terms of, you know, people coming up with ways of doing things and then how did they get shared? Because this was a period, I sort of start in 79 and I go through to 1990. So for the most part, very little involvement of the internet and so forth. So, you know, very different ways of sharing knowledge and stuff at that time. The book does focus, the majority of the book focuses on Australia the US and Canada, and the reason that was I sort of did a pretty broad kind of search through various mainstream newspapers, activist media, boxes of flyers and so forth, to try and put together as complete a picture as I felt I could of all the different blockades that happened up until 1997. And I sort of chose 97 as a kind of stop-off point for that search, because that was the year in which a couple of protest manuals, one by US Earth First and one by anti-Rhodes activists in the UK, came out. And a couple of years before that, the Intergalactic Deluxe Guide to Blockading was put out by activists in northern New South Wales. So that was a sort of a point at which, I guess, you know, how to use tactics and how to approach organising blockades kind of became codified a bit. You know, like you had a manual that you could send to people. It wasn't just about, talking to people or going to visit their campaigns or hearing a rumour about something or reading a brief account in the Earth First Journal or something and then trying to work out, how do we put a platform up in a tree or whatever. So I kind of made 97 that cutoff point. And when I looked at the hundreds of kind of blockades that happened all over the world during that time, it sort of became clear that the first three countries where blockading kind of became a sort of ongoing strategic option was Australia and Canada and the US. There were big blockading campaigns in Malaysia and Brazil, but they were very much sort of confined to one region. And so I was interested in this kind of national picture and then, you know, how did it spread around an entire country sort of thing, not just one, and spread out to different communities, not that it was a tactic or strategy that was just used in one place by one particular community. So out of all that, I sort of came to see the Terania Creek campaign in 1979 in Terania Creek, northern New South Wales, as a bit of a touchstone event. And other people had I wasn't the first person to kind of see it in this way. I guess it was a touchstone in that it was the first blockade in Australia that happened in at the point of destruction. So in Western Australia, there'd been an occupation of aluminium smelter site earlier in 1979, but which was ostensibly to protect Jarrah Forest, but it wasn't actually in the forest. So, Terania Creek, I guess, is a good example of people kind of breaking away from the formulas of the time. So they had tried lobbying, and which was the main tactic at that time. And they tried and sort of that hadn't had much success. There wasn't necessarily a lot of interest in the issue of Terania Creek. So this was a rainforest area. Rainforests at that time were not particularly prized by governments, certainly, and generally even by the public. And so what happened was, you basically had an alternative type hippie community in that area. That was a community that had lots of, I guess, practical skills. It was a community where kind of innovation and creativity were prized. And people had vaguely thought about having some kind of, picket line or something in the forest, but they hadn't really made a major plan. And then basically logging was imminent in 1979, and they called a community meeting after the Shannon Market, which is sort of a big regional hippie market. And sort of out of that, people went, look, why don't, you know, let's set up a camp in the forest and just get in the way of things. And then over the weeks that followed, they came up with a whole bunch of things that I guess, you know, later became fairly typical parts of blockades. So they occupied roads, they used consensus decision making that hadn't been used so much in sort of campaigns like this before, but within, I guess, these kind of alternative communal projects and stuff, people had used forms of consensus, so they used consensus. They did a basic form of tree sitting, you know, basically just climbing trees. They flooded roads. You know, there were tree spiking occurred. You know, and basically this was so novel that on the one hand, you know, initially the police and government didn't really know how to respond to it, but it also created a huge amount of public interest. And basically enough kind of pressure was generated, enough costs around policing, and enough kind of political damage that, you know, the logging was stopped, and the then ALP, New South Wales RAND government, sort of tried to push it all off into an inquiry, and, you know, classic sort of tactic. But, you know, eventually that forest was saved and was made part of a big national park. And so, you know, that's an example of, rather than people sort of going, OK, well, the lobbying's failed, we can't get support from the mainstream environmental groups because they think we're a bunch of sort of hopeless hippies. People came up with a whole new way of doing things and, you know, we're very successful.
That's Ian McIntyre there, and we'll return to that conversation in just a moment.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
We're speaking to Ian McIntyre, whose new book, Environmental Blockades, Obstructive Direct Action and the History of the Environmental Movement, is out at the moment. Ian, you mentioned there, I guess, creating a new way of doing things. And while there is a wealth of research into, I guess, social movements and protest movements, often, at least here in Australia, there isn't so much of a focus on direct action. Obviously, obstructive direct action is a huge focus for you in this book. And you mentioned there that, you know, activists were engaging in consensus decision making and other forms of what people might refer to as prefigurative organizing, I guess, within these protest camps. Can you talk to the, I guess, the question of direct action and how it differs from what people might refer to as protest or even civil disobedience, and why it's particularly useful in terms of, I guess, developing activist tools, but also just more broadly in terms of, I guess, potential alternatives that sometimes these protest camps experimented with?
Yeah, so I use the term obstructive direct action in the book basically because direct action is used to mean so many things. I mean, I suppose in the kind of historical syndicalist, anarchist, left libertarian type tradition, the idea of direct action is to basically directly address and solve a problem or an issue without recourse to authority or to some sort of mediating force like politicians. Now, at the same time, direct action's used to describe a whole lot of other things. You know, I mean, Tony Abbott used the term for a bit for when he was trying to get away from a carbon tax. So there's that kind of classic sense of direct action, as I say, as you know, like we can solve things ourselves without having to use authority. At the same time, direct action's often used to describe, I guess, getting in the way of things. So I use the term obstructive direct action to try and make it clear, a bit clearer what I'm talking about. And I am, you know, and I guess often the term non-violent direct action's used for a lot of this stuff, but I also wanted in the book to try and get away from some of the very simplistic kind of binaries that people have around what's non-violent direct action and what isn't, and that's there's a whole debate that sometimes gets quite hair-splitting and so forth around that. So I wanted to sort of show very clearly that, you know, with direct action here, I was talking about an obstructive form in terms of people getting directly in the way of an antisocial activity or a destructive activity. And I guess in terms of forest blockading, you know, I would see this obstructive direct action as kind of falling into rough categories. So you've sort of got soft blockades where it's mainly people using their bodies to either climb on something or to stand, you know, occupy a road or occupy a forest or stand in front of, you know, a chainsaw or a bulldozer or a dredge if it's wrecking a beach or whatever. And then you've sort of got the use of barricades, you know, so, but, yeah, piling things up in some form or creating a fort or something else. And those kind of forms of obstructive direct action obviously are very, you know, they go back to ancient times, you know, picket lines and barricades and so forth. And then I sort of, there's this kind of a third category which is around sort of enhanced or manufactured vulnerability. So that's where, I mean, putting your body in the way of something is putting yourself in a situation of vulnerability where, you know, you're trusting that the person driving the bulldozer or the police or whatever are not going to kill you or majorly harm you. And so there were a bunch of tactics such as lock-ons, you know, where people use a kryptonite lock or some other kind of lock to lock themselves to a piece of equipment, or where people, you know, climb up a platform in a tree or create a tripod and get on top of that, and that kind of enhances their vulnerability. It makes them even more vulnerable and therefore puts the onus on, you know, the opposition and the police not to hurt them. And generally, in countries like Australia, the US and Canada, at times definitely, you know, people were injured and so forth, but often the backlash around hurting or killing people was seen as too great, certainly when the media were present. So there was a space to use those kind of tactics, whereas in other countries, you know, people would just be shot or whatever, unfortunately. Yeah, and then the other kind of, I suppose, form of obstructive action or direct action that I would see would be, yeah, something like, you know, forms of sabotage. So that might be digging up a road, or it might be kind of damaging equipment and that kind of thing. Usually sabotage, I guess the more heavy forms of sabotage are usually kind of a bit separate to blockades because, you know, because of their illegal nature and the kind of penalties that can be put against them, as well as the fact that many blockaders don't agree with them, means that it's usually something that's done by small groups, sort of separate to blockades. But some blockades did include forms of sabotage, and going right back to Terania Creek, because there they, you know, deliberately flooded roads and that sort of thing. So that's one sense of direct action. But the traditional sense of direct action also feeds into this for some activists, so not for all. I mean, for many activists who are involved with blockades, they're using a form of obstructive direct action to try and force governments or outside parties to get involved and pass legislation or stop an activity or whatever. For other groups, it is about saying, you know, we can do this ourselves. We have the ability to get in the way of these things and to stop them without having to, you know, go to politicians or others to stop it. And because often the communities and the people who are involved in the early days of this stuff were kind of alternative communities who were looking for ways of living that were different to the mainstream, that were more sustainable, that were more equal and so forth, that's where something like consensus decision making, where, you know, the goal is as a group you come to a decision together and everyone's voices are heard, rather than kind of relying on voting or having one, you know, small group of people in charge, although sometimes that happens. Yeah, there was this sense of trying to create sort of something different. And I guess the other thing is that often these blockades involved protest camps, and these camps were often run on a very, and are run on a very kind of egalitarian basis, and kind of serve as, you know, laboratories for innovation, as some people have called them, because, you know, with a blockade, there's moments of intense action, but often there's a lot of waiting around. You know, if you're often setting up a blockade in itself will kind of postpone, you know, your opposition will hold off for some months, hoping that you'll fall apart or go away or whatever. And during that time, that gives a lot of opportunity for, you know, people to discuss tactics, strategies, ways of doing things differently. So yeah, there's quite a lot of variety within blockades in terms of their goals, but certainly for some, the blending of the kind of obstructive direct action of directly getting in the way and stopping something certainly blends into the wider idea of direct action and kind of changing society and finding new ways of doing things.
Now, Ian, obviously this is a historical work and looking very much at blockades from the 80s and 90s. However, you do finish the book looking forward from 1990 and the development of environmental blockading since then. We now live in a world in which the realities of catastrophic climate change are ever more pressing, with the IPCC giving us really less than a decade to avoid catastrophic climate change, even if that is possible in itself. What do you hope people might get from this book in terms of looking at today's climate justice movements and blockading? There are, of course, still blockades ongoing here in Western Australia and elsewhere around the country, in particular thinking of places such as those that are on the ground in Queensland trying to stop the Adani coal mine from going ahead. What do you hope people will get from the book in terms of looking forward at potential tactics, especially when considering the issue of climate justice and taking on some of the fossil fuel companies?
Yeah, I think some things that I learned from working on the book and from having, you know, interviewed around 30 activists who are involved in, as I said before, what I see is this kind of period where blockading became, you know, a strategic option, and sort of, you know, nearly all of them are still active in some way. And, you know, some of them were involved very early on in pointing out, you know, that the dangers of climate change and, you know, the greenhouse effect, as it was more typically referred to in the 80s. So I guess in terms of what I think people can draw out, well, I think one thing that I certainly picked up from it, you know, and as I talked about earlier, is that there's no specific formula for success. However, having, you know, there's a really, it's very important to kind of combine planning, strategy, having metrics, you know, measuring what success is, that kind of thing, and combining that with some intuition and spontaneity. And that's a tricky tension, but it's one that often exists within a lot of campaigns. You know, so some campaigns are, you know, that certainly probably the most that majority I've been involved with are very kind of ad hoc, and, you know, and others are extremely planned out and kind of follow, you know, a particular plan and then don't divert much from that plan. So one of the things that occurred to me, you know, that came out of this for me was, yeah, there's no specific formula, but, you know, if you can look at what's been done in the past, that can help you to kind of think about what's that kind of balance between planning and strategy, and then allowing for kind of intuition and spontaneity. It really underlines, I think, the importance of new tactics, but tactics don't have to be entirely new. You can adapt something that's been done before, or you can return to old tactics that haven't been used in quite a while, or use them in a sort of unexpected way. And if you do something that's a bit different, you are more likely to be successful and grab attention. I guess another thing that I would say is that, you know, looking at these campaigns, blockading kind of rarely works on its own in terms of a blockade, you know, simply being, you know, just being able to get enough people to completely shut down work forever. There's often it has to happen with, you know, a kind of broader strategies, which, you know, might involve legal cases, and they might involve lobbying, they might involve changing governments, they might involve pushing towards some sort of rebellion against governments. But, you know, these things don't tend to happen on their own, but blockading can enhance all those other strategies, and in turn, they can, yeah, those other strategies can enhance blockading. So it's a tool. And I think blockading often works best when it is combined with other strategies and where different kinds of activists are open to working together. And they don't have to be closely working together. There were cases, certainly in the US, where, you know, activists that were using quite confrontational sort of legal strategies, they were liaising and essentially working together with activists who were doing stuff blockading in the forest, but officially there was kind of, you know, some space between them and stuff. And I think another thing that really came out was that to prevent isolation of particular issues and health blockaders, it's really important to kind of connect to broader issues and communities. The last thing I should say is that, yeah, blockading, you know, can certainly work. It can backfire. Sometimes, you know, using a blockade, there's cases in the book where it really alienated local communities, and it really gave an opportunity for, you know, people who wanted to tear down forests or destroy beaches or dam rivers. It gave, you know, the blockading kind of was a catalyst that allowed those groups to kind of really get their act together and, you know, succeed. But more typically, blockading, you know, can really generate a whole bunch of outcomes, and that includes things such as stopping and delaying work, which is the main thing that people often want. I mean, it can show how involved, you know, governments which may say that they are neutral, how close they actually are to big business and so forth, because it sort of forces them to get involved by, you know, using the police and what have you. Blockades can really bring communities together. They can bring, you know, Indigenous communities and non-Indigenous communities together. Sometimes they can drive them apart. But, you know, as a form of action, it's one that certainly at the end of the day really flies the flag and really shows, you know, just how committed people are to stopping something and replacing it.
That was Ian McIntyre talking about his new book, Environmental Blockades, Obstructive Direct Action and the History of the Environmental Movement. And that's available now. You can get it via Routledge Press. Can find them online. You can also read a bunch of and listen to a bunch of his interviews at the commonslibrary.org. Free access there. And that's definitely all the time we've got left on the show this week. We'll be back next week, though. Until then, have a great week. And as we say every week on the Indie Media Show, don't hate the media, become the media.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.